tonight. I'm on board Traditional Boats in Dublin, and we'll hear from an Irish boat spending 2 years working on a climate change documentary in Greenland. Earlier in the summer, I took part in a Traditional Boat Regatta and Poolbeg Yacht Club in Dublin. Run by an organisation called the Old Gaffers Association, traditional hookers and other boats like them are part of a very vibrant scene all around the coast. That day, I went aboard several of the boats and met their crews. First was Nave Cronon, a Galway hooker built in Dublin.
Paul Keogh, skipper of the Nave Cronon.
Nave Cronon, a Galway Bay hooker uniquely built in Dublin. Tell me something about her.
She was the brainchild of a man called Michael Heffron from Oras Cronon. And at some stage, there was a programme on the telly, and they were watching the telly, and with a few drinks taken, they said, we could build one of them. And nobody believed him, but he was a stubborn man and got stuck in, and it happened. And Quilche sponsored the timber. A local builder, I think his name was Kelly, sponsored a shed, which they had to build a shed before they started building a boat. And 4 years later, out came the Nave Cronon.
And she was built in Clondalkin. Am I right in saying it was a community effort?
It was a community effort, as much as possible done in Oscoelga. She's owned and run by the Oras Cronon and Irish Culture Club in Clondalkin.
Tell me about her. What size is she?
She's 40 foot on the deck. She's the lines were taken off a shipwright called Joe Murphy, God be gone to him. He took the lines off the Morning Star and put them onto plans. And he and a fellow called Johnny Helian, another shipwright who owned the Morning Star, supervised the project right through to the finish.
Is she sailing now at the moment? Is this your first outing this year?
This is the first race this year. She went very, very well. We got into second place by a boat length. We've done a lot of work over the winter with a new mast, a hollow mast, and the difference of the boat, it's a different boat altogether, far better.
How do you mean a hollow mast? What's the difference between this and what was there beforehand?
The new mast going in was a half a tonne, and the old mast coming out, which was bare, didn't have blocks in her, was 1.2 tonne. So it's a huge difference in the boat. We can take her tighter to the wind. She's different
performance. Yeah, you carry much more sail.
We can carry more sail. You don't have to spill the wind as quick.
How much maintenance is on this, and where do you keep it during the winter? Everybody, when you talk about a wooden boat, everyone laughs when you ask about maintenance.
Basically, this is probably the first men's shed we hear a lot of, but like every Saturday in the summer we sail, and every Saturday over the winter, weather permitting, we work. Like we take on a project to keep her, maintain her, and we might need a plank change, and whatever needs to be done, we just get stuck in and try and do as much as possible ourselves.
Do you have to paint the hull every year?
Every year the hull is scraped down, painted, anti-fouled.
Is there much re-caulking to be done?
It varies. We would check all the caulking. This year we had to put in a couple of short planks, possibly a couple of them are suspect now. For next year there might be two big ones. But it's all keeps us out of trouble. It's good crack.
Where have you been on her?
In 2000 we went down to the Traditional Boat Festival in Brest in France. Back again in 2004. We haven't been since, but we would go every year to the Isle of Man on a bit of a cruise, maybe up to Scotland, Northern Ireland. We'd follow the Traditional Boat Regattas run by mostly OGA.
Do you go over to the West Coast?
We've never been over.
How come?
We tried to go over in 2008 and the weather turned on us. We were stuck in Kilmore Quay or Dungarvan for a couple of days, and we're on holidays. Ran out of time.
Yeah.
Oh, someday when we retire, we'll base it over there for a season and race it for a season.
You have all the electronic gear on board.
We have GPS and plotters. We will be big on safety. Maybe carry a life raft, navigation, EPIRB, radios. Try and do things as much as possible to the book, by the book.
I've been on hookers before, and the one thing I notice about them is that they're very heavy on the tiller. What's this one like?
Mortar. Yeah. Mortar.
You could have two people on the tiller.
Yeah, back is broken. Two people on the tiller. If you need two people on the tiller, you have too much sail. It can be quite dangerous. Because one person, if you have to dump the tiller, can't get out of the way.
Yeah.
So I don't like sailing that way. If it's too heavy, there's something wrong.
Why were they designed in that way?
They weren't designed to race like we do. Okay. They were designed to carry cargo. And the sails would have been, our sails would be quite small compared to the ones in the west of Ireland. But when they were working boats, they were even smaller. They were managed by a man and a boy. Like there's six of us here, and at times, and like the race out there, it was hard going, the six of us.
Donal Green is one of the shipwrights for the Naoimh Cronan.
Well, I am a shipwright. I'm based on the west of Ireland, but I'm working in Dublin here. I'm working as a woodwork teacher in College de Chilean in Clondalkin. So I've known the lads for years, and that's one of the reasons I took the job up here. And I've over the years helped them out with repairs, and there this year we made a new mast.
I've just been looking at pictures of the mast. Tell me how you went about it.
It's a laminated mast, so it's a hollow mast. So it's laminated up in sections, scarfed. All the sections are scarfed using glue, and it's hollowed out inside. So I drew it up actually on the AutoCAD. We drew it up, and at every 6 foot sections, we knew the diameter of the mast. We also got to calculate how much to safely remove for the load, and that was how we made our calculations, and we made it to that plan. And it was a team effort. We made it over the winter down in the shed in Wicklow, and it was every weekend for about about 6 weeks, and it didn't take long. We made it in two halves, and then they were just literally just doubled over and clamped together, and we were very happy that it worked out.
Today was his first outing.
It was first proper outing. Yes, we had it out there about a week ago, but today was the first day we had a bit of wind. And it was just actually one of the guys there sent us a video, so I was just looking at see if there was any distortions or anything. And,
okay.
Yeah, I'm very happy with how it's worked out.
How did you enter the shipwright trade?
It was always in my family. My father's people down in Carna were always involved with boats. And years and years ago, about 1996, the Galway Hooker Association had a scheme where they got 10 guys as apprentices, and we did our apprenticeship. And out of that, four fellas got into boat building full time. And I worked for years as a full-time boat right, and then I went into education as well.
Did you have a yard down in Galway yourself?
I do. I still have it back in Carna.
What's it called?
Just Donal Green, just boat building. Yeah, we'd be known as in the west we'd be fluent Irish speakers, so we'd be known as Sir Bod, which is the old terminology for a boat right.
Are you building anything at the moment?
I have a few repairs in the workshop at the moment. I'd have the holidays. School closed yesterday, so it's back to most people are going to Spain for the holidays, but I'm going to work, and it's a bit of a working holiday. So I have a few jobs on there, bits and pieces, and I have a boat out in Malahide. I bought there about a week ago, so I'm actually going to do a bit of work on that as well, and try and transport it down to the west.
The Galway hooker scene down in west of Ireland is very vibrant.
Extremely. It's fantastic. Even as we speak today, there's a race on in Rossmuck, a regatta in Rossmuck. There's a regatta almost every weekend, and it's fantastic. There's at any given time, you could have maybe 20 to 30 boats out, and it's fantastic. And it's really, really competitive. Like, the sailing is really competitive, and it's great fun. I suppose the social aspect of it as well is it's very nice. You know, it brings people together. You know, a lot of the friends we have through sailing, and it's part of in the West, I suppose, it's part of who we are. We were reared on that. You know, it's in our terminology, it's in our blood. It's our identity, really. And you know, we're very, very, very proud of it. And you know, it takes a lot of hard work to keep it going, but there's a great group of people there that are really committed to doing it. And you know, like, no one is making a profit out of it. It's an expensive hobby, but it's something that's very worth keeping. And I think we have a living history there. That's, you know, that's a weekly living history. A
number of people have been down the west of Ireland and here now as well today have mentioned large to me that it's only lasting a couple of years. What's the issue?
There's a lot of issues. Traditionally, larch was the larch you had years ago was grown slowly. It was slow grown larch. It was probably dried longer as well. Today, larch has been cut. It's been cut probably the wrong time of year a lot of the time because of the commercial world we live in. You know, these fellas don't stop for the summer months. So plus a lot of the larch that's growing at the moment is a hybrid. It's grows too quickly. The grain is too soft. And it's simply not lasting. Now, coupled with that as well, a lot of the modern paints, if anything, are probably too good, so they're actually sealing in. Like, I'm a big believer now, and when you're caulking a boat, I still use oakum. I don't use cotton because I prefer to use oakum and red lead putty because I think it's more breathable. It allows the timber to breathe. And so there are massive problems. People are looking at perhaps using teak and things like that. Personally, if I was going to build something big tomorrow morning, I think I'd go for Canadian yellow pine.
Also in Poolbeg, I met Sean Walsh, who showed me around his boat, T Tiernanogue of Howth.
She's actually a replica of a Falmouth working boat, an oyster boat out of Falmouth. But instead of a fish well, she has a cabin, because they're quite extraordinary boats. They're a working platform for working men at sea. And yachtsmen have found that they're powerful and weatherly, and they go like the clappers. And so I've been sailing her for 25 years and I love her to bits.
Is there much maintenance? She's completely wood?
No, she has a glass fibre GRP hull, but all the rest, as you can see yourself, the decks and the cabin are wood, as befits a traditional wooden boat yard. They didn't particularly like the GRP hull, but they suffered it and they put a wooden top on it.
Now, tell me something about her, where you've been on her.
Well, we've been to Brest and Douarnenez festivals about three times. We've been to the Outer Hebrides, at least six times, Scotland and all of this, all around, over to the UK so many times, Wales and that sort of thing. And, of course, around Ireland, and the best cruising in the world down in West Cork. This year, for the first time, we intend to do a circumnavigation. We're heading north about and circling our beautiful island for the first time. For at least a decade, I've wanted to do it, and this is my opportunity.
And you're going to go around the other way, you're going north first.
Going north about, just to be contrary.
Now, just looking around here, you've got your cookery, everything. You have a solid fuel heater.
This is a beautiful thing. It comes from the garret, the housekeeper's room in a French chateau. And she, in the morning, as she gets up and ready to go to work, she puts a stew on a pot here.
Yeah.
And at lunchtime, when she's finished her work, she comes up and her stew is ready. And my kettle fits on it. It takes one peat briquette, for 2.5 hours. And it's the most beautiful thing, because it warms the whole boat. And I love it to bits. And I tiled the surround there because it produces so much heat that this chimney...
The flue
glows red hot, so you have to. I had to get a special cover to cover it, but it's beautiful.
This your table.
This table drops down, and a cushion goes over it, and that is the bridal suite.
Okay.
And she's got heads in here, two berths forward, so she has four berths in all. And this is particularly the chart table is here. All the charts in the order in which we. We'll use them underneath.
You're
here.
Very organised.
And
you've even got your passport in there just in case you take a wrong turn.
My fridge, okay. Door fridge, which is wonderful. So that's it, really. I've been sailing for 25 years. She's a gaff cutter with a topsail. And I'm hoping that any year now I'll get the hang of it.
Where did she come from?
She came... she was commissioned by Jerry McAvoy in Howth Yacht Club. He was the treasurer there in 92 from Gaffers and Loggers in Tregneath, Cornwall, Truro. And within that first year, I had visited him as a marketeer in IBM. And we had a great conversation, which sort of went along the lines. I nervously said... funny weather we're having these days. And he said, yes, it is. He says, it's we don't get southeasterlies at this time of year. So I knew I had a sailor. So I asked him what kind of boat he had. And he said, I have a Falmouth working boat. And he gave me the kind of grin which says, no, I have you. You don't know. But he didn't know that a classic boat had an article on it 2 months before. And I knew all about the...
Okay.
So we had this great conversation, which ended up with him ordering coffee. And within 3 weeks, I was sailing on the boat, and I sailed with him for 11 years until he sadly got an aneurysm in his head and died in a short time. But I bought the boat from him before then. But great loss.
Beautiful. What's she like to handle?
She's a dream to handle. She's powerful. Weatherly, she doesn't have any lifelines.
Okay, there's no handrails, yeah.
Yeah, she's 8.5 tons and 5.5 it is ballast down there. So she's powerful. She's a short mast, but her sail plan is long because she's got an 18-foot bowsprit going out the front, so her sail plan is elongated, and she'll hold her full working sail in a 4-7 going to 4-8.
Wow. Okay.
So she's powerful and weathery.
And when you say ballast, it's not a lead keel, it's stuff you put in and out.
It's a boiler punching, steel boiler punchings, 5.5 tons of it, dropped into the hollow down here, and then they put resin, fiberglass resin over it, so it's entombed down there.
Okay.
And it doesn't matter if you hit something in form, because she's solid all the way back to here.
Yeah.
And there's a well under the engine, but she's just under here, there's under the floorboards, there's just 1 inch, and she's GRP down there.
After 25 years sailing, the boat, you must be very attached.
You could say that. I just can't conceive of life without her at this stage, because she's been such a wonderful enhancement of my life. It's a great sport, a wonderful sport. You meet wonderful people, and it's really great to have a wonderful boat to share with them.
You're getting emotional about her.
Yes, of course. I always have been.
Thanks to Sean Walsh, the crew of the Nave Cronon, and everybody at Pool Bay Yacht Club. Irish adventurer Jamie Young has sailed solo across the Atlantic twice. He's the founder of the Killary Adventure Centre, and earlier this summer he left Leenane in County Galway on board his yacht Killary Flower with a Dutch and Irish crew bound for Greenland. They're involved in a 2-year project documenting the impact of the climate crisis on the world's largest island, and we've been hearing about that over the last few days. Before they left Ireland, Lorna Siggins was on board the Killary Flyer, speaking to Jamie and to the Dutch film producer Marieke Lexmond.
The story which we're creating is all on a greenlandstory.com, and it's going to be a trip from here on the west coast of Ireland, Killary Fjord, to the west coast of Greenland, to the capital, Nuuk, and further up to Assiat and Sisimut and Disko Island, all names you will have never heard of before. Well, most of the trips I've been on have been... I've never wanted to be the first or the fastest or the highest or whatever it is. It's to try and go to some of these unusual areas and meet the people along the way, and try and understand a little bit as to what their motivation is, and what are these remote communities have always been of interest to me, because you've got so many factors at play there. For instance, when I go on holiday, the last place I want to go is a city. I would always go to somewhere more remote. For sure. So when I went to the South Pole, we were trying to kite buggy back. I would have no interest in dragging a sledge for miles and miles and miles. Perhaps I'm just lazy. I would rather get pulled along by the wind. We did go sea kayaking around Cape Horn. That was way back in 1990. Pinochet was still in power, so we had to deal with the military all the way. And that was a fascinating experience. And I was on the South Reach trip, which was to follow in the footsteps and the wake of Shackleton and Tom Crean and all those Antarctic heroes. And we managed to survive having to depart our boat in the middle of the Scotia Sea, and we did land in Kinghaken Bay, which is on the west side, more or less, of...
You capsized 3 times.
Yes, we did. That was that's why we decided to leave the boat in the end. We got caught in a storm, and it was a small... The Tom Crean was a copy of the James Caird, which is the exact boat which Shackleton and his team sailed from Elephant Island to South Georgia. But there's nothing which clarifies the mind when you're staring down into the ocean upside down. So, I think...
Did you think you mightn't survive that one?
Well, at the time, yes, I remember I was with... we were in a small cabin. There was a few of us, Paddy, Barry, Jarlath Conan, and myself. And so I ended up kneeling on what was the roof, looking out through a small Perspex hatch, and just wondering, you know, was this it, or are we going to come back up again? But you can't do anything about it, and the worst thing to do is to panic.
And have you felt that way before in any of your other your solo trips?
Well, I've also done the Austar. That was way back in 1976, and the Austar is the Observer single-handed transatlantic race, which is still going, at both ways, actually, because I borrowed a boat off somebody and I didn't have any money, so had to bring the boat back. Apart from the sort of traditional activities of the Inuit, and we were exposed to some of them last time we went, there's a lot going on in terms of mining, for instance, and that promises to be quite a complex future, because last year was the first year that they've allowed for the mining of uranium, for instance, which tends to be in the same place as other rare earths. And the Chinese are very keen to seem to appear to corner the market in rare earths, and they're moving into Greenland. They've bought quite a big percentage of the publicly quoted Australian mining company that is exploring the possibilities. And there's quite an argument itself going on within Greenland about how mining is going to affect their way of life and the environment they live in, and everything that surrounds that, no more than it does in the west of Ireland in so many quite similar ways. You know, is it going to be benefit? Is it going to employ people? Is it going to leave a massive scar which will never recover? And some people in Greenland will argue that they should be allowed to live as we do, whilst others in the West say that it should be preserved and everything that surrounds it. So that's a difficult equation for us all. And I think part of climate change is how, over the thousands of years they've lived in Greenland, they've changed and adapted to the changes which we are going to have to get used to as well. Leenan itself, as we were talking about earlier, is now in danger of getting yearly floods, which going right into some of the houses. And I'm sure there are many other places along the West Irish coast where winter storms are going to bring what were regarded as rare events as to actually quite common events. There's a big reaction. This is some of the rest, the other content in the film. The reaction to the Inuit shooting and eating some of the what we would regard as wildlife, seals. They shoot the seals to eat, but also to feed their dogs. They also shoot polar bears. There is a quota, but they're readily available. And last time we were up there, we managed to be part of a confirmation party where they were eating traditional food, which was polar bear, beluga, whale meat, seal meat, all sorts of things like that. But they are aware that when people see them shooting seals or other wildlife, they're getting quite a negative reaction. And I think that's unfair of us in the West to judge them on that. It's been their way of life for thousands of years. There's still seals there, there's still polar bears there, there's musk ox, caribou. They haven't vanished, and they don't kill for sport, they kill to eat, and that's a pretty solid distinction, I think.
Mm-hmm. So, Marika, how different is this documentary to the ones you've made before?
Well, I think it's pretty amazing that they make this trip to begin with, to go from here to Greenland and to make the crossing and go between the icebergs. And I find it already quite an adventure. And on top of that, they're going to make the documentary, which is a, quite an adventurous exercise on itself. So they have a tough one going, I think.
And you'll be following their progress from here?
I will. I'll be the man on the land and keep everybody posted. And yeah, I'm looking forward. I can't wait for the pictures and everything.
And you plan then to go yourself next year?
Absolutely. I'm actually getting a little jealous at the moment.
You were mentioning that the various expeditions I've or experiences I've been on, but once you've done one or two, it sort of becomes an attraction in itself. And to, you know, live at those extremes, it can be very boring, it can be hugely exciting, it can be fascinating, and you can see sights that you'd never think you'd ever see. And it's kind of difficult to relate that sometimes to what you might call real life.
A search and rescue pilot once said, "It's hours of boredom, moments of terror."
He wouldn't be wrong.
Lorna Siggins speaking to Jamie Young and the crew of the Killary Flyer.